Ty and Steve from Naples, Florida.
Thank you, Alan. My name's Don. I'm an alcoholic. I have... It's you again. I have been also referred to as the previous problem and a few other things, but I'm pleased to be here. I bring you tidings from my home group, which is the Thursday night loosely wrapped group in Marco Island, Florida. It's a very special meeting. I know we all think of our meeting that way. We start at 6:30, and we have dinner. There'll be four to a dozen of us. Then we go over to the Alano Club, which we had especially built for this particular meeting, because this is the big cigar smoking meeting. And we have a room there that has special ventilation that'll just pull the smoke out of your mouth before you throw it out. And you know how drunks are when they get on a project. And we got this thing all designed, and there's a lot of sobriety in the meeting. I mean, most everyone has their own cups, and they've got their name and sobriety date on it, and most everyone has a special chair where they sit. And during the snowbird season, it can be disruptive. Some of them snowbirds get in the wrong seat, you know, and we have to kind of get things rearranged. And we have a big parking lot out there, and it's kind of understood that the front row is reserved for the double-digit sobriety. And someone with the wrong license plate will get in there, and we have to move cars before the meeting can start. And I mean, but once we get her going, I mean, it's a good meeting. So you get down to Marco Island on Thursday night. You come on down to the Alano Club. We'll be tickled to death to see you. We'll have a good meeting. And, of course, as Ellie mentioned, I'm not a Floridian. I'm like most people. I'd be from Florida. I'm from somewhere else. I left my battle scars up in Illinois, up in the Champaign-Urbana area. And when I was up there, I was a member of the Tuesday Night Investment Club group. And my sponsor, who is in his 80s now, my original sponsor, is still alive up in Illinois. And I have a Florida sponsor that I've had for quite some time. And because of those sponsors, because of these meetings I mentioned, because of meetings like this and a lot of stuff like goes on around here at these meetings, my sobriety date is October 23rd, 1969. Now, I don't expect any applause. I just want you to know something. I thought I saw a guy from Texas, and I didn't want him to leave. And if they don't hear numbers, they just get up and go. They want to know. They want to know when this thing happened. I was having lunch yesterday, and Mrs. Enthusiasm, I call her Babs, from up in Charlotte, she came by, and she looked me right straight in the eye. She said, "I've heard you a couple times." Well, you know, sometimes you don't know how to take that. And so I said, about all you can say, "Well, here I am again." You know, it's kind of like that Scotchman that Mary was talking about last night. This Scotchman, he'd had a bad drinking problem. He finally got himself settled down. He got into AA. And like most drunks, not only was he Scot, he was tight with his money because he was Scot. You know how us drunks are. When we used to throw money around when we didn't have it, we get sobered up, we get a little bit, but we get pretty close with her. And saw a few of those. He was having a bad time because he knew that he was going to have to go see the doctor because he had this bad pain in his stomach. And this almost caused him to have a setback because he knew he was going to have to spend some of them hard-earned dollars to pay this high-priced doctor. But he couldn't take her anymore, and he went down and he said, "I'll go into the doctor's building where they have a lot of doctors, and maybe I can find a bargain in there." And he was up there, and he was going up and down the halls, and pretty soon he spotted a sign on there, and it said, "Dr. William L. Jackson, first call, $35. Second call, and all subsequent calls, $15. He said, "There's my man." He went in, he got before the doc, he says, "Well..." Here I am again, Doc. Well, the doc examined him a little bit, and he said, "Well, you remember what you had when you was in here before, don't you?" Well, the drunk said, "Oh, yes, I sure do." Well, the doc says, "You got her again." Now, he says, "You just take the same medicine that I prescribed for you before and give the cashier $15 on the way out." So that's about all I can say is, here I am again. And it's good to be here. And what a pleasure to see Charles and Jay and Ann and all the group. I hate to start mentioning names, but it's sure good to see Jay loosen up a little bit, isn't it? Boy, he was taking this thing serious, laying down the law here until this morning, and then he just kind of backed off and let us go. So we're going to have some fun. And, of course, the committee and everyone has done such a good job. It's just been wonderful from beginning to end, and I know there's going to be a car waiting out there for me to get me to the airport, and it's wonderful. And then I look over here, and I see Buck. Old Buck, you know, at the taping table, 33 years he had this year. That's a long time without a drink, isn't it, Buck? A long time. Buck's had help, you know. Virginia, you all know Virginia. Black Belt, Virginia. I have reliable information that tells me she's the only lady in Al-Anon that we know who has a complete wardrobe of black belts. And she just selects them by the day, you know. And she wears them out. So it's been fun, Buck. It's good to see you, and always good to see see Mike. Meetings like this are great. This has just been a well-oiled machine from the time I got here. They're always special. They have an intensity about them, the drama. We have a lot of fun, a good time, And I think I discovered some time ago why these meetings always run so well. It's because we've been brought here by our tragedies. And we're alive because of each other. And that gives a very meaningful experience. You see, I have no qualms in standing before you today and telling you that I can't make it without you. And the reason I say that with deep conviction is because I try. You see, I didn't come in here because I saw the light. I came in here because I felt the heat. And when you feel the heat, and you heard one of the heaters talk yesterday morning, if you were here, and she's a pretty good heater. So that's the reason I think that they're always so special. I enjoyed that introduction that I got this morning, and boy, that introduction Charles gave Mary last night was just warmed my heart. You know, it's not easy to introduce a drunk. I've never heard anyone get up here and give a broad educational background of a drunk, have you? I've never heard anyone get up here and give a vast business background of a drunk. No one seems to care how much money or how little you got, who you know, who you don't know. Don't seem to make much difference. The most important piece of data seems to be where he's from. I mean, there just isn't much to work with. So I always enjoy the introductions. Of course, one of the greatest stories I heard about introductions, they were telling me at this business meeting, a gentleman got up there and he introduced this business executive. He built him up, up, up. He says, "You're going to enjoy this great man." Said he made $1 million in the oil business in California. Well, the speaker got up there. He shuffled his notes around a little bit. He said, what the chairman said about me is essentially so. He says, the only thing, it wasn't the oil business. It was the coal business. And he said, it wasn't California. It was Pennsylvania. And he said, it wasn't $1 million, it was $100,000, and it wasn't me, it was my brother, and he didn't make it, he lost it. So, so, Alan, you did well. Thank you very much. I just love these open meetings because it's got my favorite people in it, and I'm talking about the Al-Anons. I just love these Al-Anons. You know, my wife's been in Al-Anon for 32 years. Why? I remember when she started going to Al-Anon, her case was so acute that we had to start her into Al-Anon before I even got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. But she got to go into this thing, and I got a little confused. You know, she'd get all dressed up on Wednesday night. She'd go to this meeting, and then she'd come back. She seemed to be getting a little peace and tranquility about her. She wasn't near as mouthy as she used to be. And after about 6 weeks, I got to thinking, I wonder what's going on. So I announced to her delight that I'd be going with her next Wednesday night, and I was going to check out this AA meeting, and we did. Went to the church. She had me by the arm. Of course, she knew the terrain. I was new. We walked in. She said, now, the Al-Anons meet on back here in the Sunday school room. And she said, the AAs are right here. And she shoved me in that room. And while I was getting one of those good seats in the back row, I noticed she was up there whispering something to the chairman. Well, now, I don't know what she said, but here's what I think she said. I think she said, if you'll sober him up, boy, I'll keep him humble. And I want you to know, she's still working at her job today, yeah. We were coming home the other night from a social event. She looked over at me. She said, did I ever tell you that you were handsome and witty and vivacious and just a regular devil with the women folk? Well, I said, no, dear, no, you never did. Well, she said, I wonder what gave you that idea at the party tonight. Well, you may have guessed by now that I like to have a good time. And to me, Alcoholics Anonymous is having a good time. I feel that laughter is one of the most important healing agents for me and for those people that we have affected with our disease of alcoholism. That it's a real healing agent. So I like to have a good time. You see, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I thought I'd just check the fun at the door. I'd never again have a good time. And, of course, I was wrong. And you convinced me of that, and I thank you for it at meetings like this. I've always been excited by the miracles that I see in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. When I was out drinking, I used to think that a miracle that I was praying for was just being able to find my car and get that thing started and get home without the police getting me. That was my miracle. Sometimes I'd get a half a miracle. But I didn't know, and you taught me, that God presents to us his miracles through people. How many times have we sat in meetings and looked at someone that's come through, as people I know who've been through the DTs two or three times, and you look at them and they're moving out and they're working with people, and you say, that's a miracle. And that's one of God's miracles. And I didn't know that. You taught me that here. I was raised down in southern Illinois. We call it raised down there. A lot of people say grow up. I really didn't grow up. I just was raised down there in southern Illinois, right down there where the Bible Belt and the Poverty Belt just kind of merge, you know. And I was the youngest of four boys, and I had drinks with all my brothers. And yet I'm the only one that ended up with the disease of alcoholism. Now, I came from what they call a get-by family. Now, if you don't know what a get-by family is, I just described it. I mean, we just got by. A lot of people would say that we were economically deprived. But I imagine by today's standards, we may have had a social worker that might check in once a couple weeks or something like that. But it was a good family. No booze in my family. My mother hated alcohol, and she would not allow it in the house. Saw my dad drink one beer in his whole life, and he was 150 miles away from home, and I knew Mom would catch him. The town that I was from, not only was there no alcohol, I mean, they were against it. You know, what I mean? They were organized. The church groups had names and this type of thing, and they were out fighting that thing, and they didn't want it. They didn't want it in our town. Now, in school, I was just an average student. That might be stretching it just a little bit, but, you know, I really didn't like school. The only thing that kept me in school was sports. I loved sports. You see, I was captain of the baseball team for 4 years, captain of the basketball team for 2 years, and failing to see inner one overly impressed by the magnitude of what I just said, make sure you're not going down on me. Let me run you through that again. What they said was that I got the most hits, I made the most baskets, so we want him to be the captain of the team. And that's the only thing that really kept me in sports. I love to win. I've coined a lot of phrases, and, you know, this program has allowed me to travel all over the world, it seems like, many other countries. But, you know, of all the places in the world I've ever been, there's no place like first place. And I've found a lot of people in the program just like me. They love to win. Never played in a basketball game that I didn't think if it'd last another minute, we could win. If we were in a baseball game, we were 15 runs behind, give us one more inning, we'll catch them. You know, no place like first place. And I love that. Well, I was about to enter my first year in high school. They used to call us freshmen then. I think they call it junior high or something like that. But I was working in a grocery store, and I used to notice about 3 o'clock in the afternoon that the proprietor would meet over at the restaurant with some of the other proprietors of the businesses up and down Main Street, and they would go dragging in there on those hot days like we're having now, and they'd come out, and they were all fired up, and my boss would come back, and he's all ready to go to work, and I said, "What goes on over there? You guys go in over there, you're half dead, you come out 30 minutes later, you're all excited and enthusiastic, ready to go to work." He said, "We have a little coffee royal." Well, I said, "I'd like to get some of that coffee raw." Well, he said, "Maybe someday." A couple weeks later, he invited me over. He said, "Come on." He went over there. We got in the back room of this restaurant, and he said, "Give Don a little coffee raw." And they did. You see, I didn't know that they had laced that black coffee with whiskey. And I drank that coffee raw. And a miraculous thing happened to me. I felt the way I'd always wanted to feel. Didn't even know I wanted to feel that way until I felt it. It was a tremendous feeling. I mean, that drink did for me what the phone booth does for Clark Kent. It was exciting. Everything got bigger, including me. And I went back over to the store. And I had a zip in my step, and I had the look of an eagle in my eye, and I was ready to go. I was all fired up. And from that day until I became actively involved with you, I was obsessed with drinking. I sneak drink all the way through high school, even with the things that I did in sports. I sneak drink all the way through high school. And I just obsessed with drinking. I just loved the feeling. Didn't particularly care for the taste, but I loved that feeling. And only you understand that. When I got out of school, I had a job waiting for me. My whole family were railroaders, and I'd learned the Morse code between my junior and senior year, and I got out of work. I went to work at the Illinois Central Railroad. Worked as telegraph operator, promoted to train dispatcher, then the chief train dispatcher. 11 years I labored with the Illinois Central Railroad. And then finally, the steam engines started leaving, and the diesels came in, and the job market started shrinking, and it was strictly a seniority thing. And the next thing I knew, my chosen profession was shrinking, and I had to find something else to do. So I found me a new job. I became a salesman. Now, you would never have guessed that. But I did. I got into the sales field, and I tell you, when I got into the sales field, this was exciting. This was a new world. I had never seen the American system of free enterprise work. You see, every job I'd had, you always worked 8 hours a day, you get paid so much money, and Friday comes around, you get paid, and you're kind of in a limited thing. But I was working on straight commission. This meant the more you sold, the more money you made. And I made a lot of sales. And if you didn't have all you want by Friday, you can work Saturday. Why, I want you to know I sold up a storm. I got write-ups in trade magazines. I was wanted to be at speakers at conventions and things like this. Oh, man, I tell you, I sold. It was great, and I was drinking more whiskey, and I was drinking a better whiskey. And because of the recognition, and I finally ended up with an organization that sold sales organizations. And I was one of the teachers. I mean, this was selling. I loved it. But as I was moving along in this profession, and I was drinking more whiskey and making more money, finally there was a new company that was being formed right there in Champaign, Urbana. And they came over and asked me if I would be a corporate officer, if I would hire the sales organization and train them. And I did. And at one time, I had 220 salesmen working for me. And we were handling an initial public offering of the company. And we had a real pressure situation because you had to get the stock all sold within a certain period of time or the promoters had to give their money back. And I just happened to be one of the promoters at that time. And I didn't want to give my money back. And I was working day and night with these guys. I was meeting every night with them at different parts of the states and getting them all fired up and collecting the money. And, boy, we were rolling. And on the road all the time. And one Friday night, I was coming back from a little town up there, a big town called Rockford, Illinois. I had 4 hours to drive. I didn't mind driving because I had my suitcase on the back seat. I had a quart of whiskey in the suitcase. And I just reached down, get a drink, and I'd stick her back in the suitcase. And then if the police showed up, I'm clean. And I made the mistake that old Norm Alfie out in California, Norm's dead now, but Norm always said it's okay to think and it's okay to drink, but don't try to think and drink. Well, I came home and I was drinking and I was thinking. And what I was thinking is there's a lot of crazy people out here on this highway driving their automobiles around. And I could be killed out here. And I've got a couple young kids and a wife, and they should be taken care of in case something happens to me. So I should buy more life insurance. And besides that, I'm an officer in a life insurance company. So the next Monday morning, as busy as I was, I finally got 15 minutes to run down and see the company doctor to take the examination that you have to take to buy more life insurance. Well, I went in to see the doc. He started examining me, my eyes, my throat, took my temperature, felt my pulse, looked down my ears, up my nose, all that kind of stuff. And he kind of stepped back, and I looked at him, and I said, "Well, Doc, how do I stand?" Well, he said, "That's what I can't figure out." He said, "You're not in very good shape." You know, for a young guy, 35 years old, he said, "Your blood pressure's up. You're a little overweight." He said, "You seem to be working under some kind of stress here." He said, "It's hard to examine someone walking back and forth in my office like this, but," he said, "we can do it." But he said, "you seem to be under stress." He said, "I suggest you go over here to Carl Clinic here in Urbana, Illinois, that big clinic, and see the doctor over there and get your examination." And I did. Well, I went over there, and it was not a good scene. I went in to see the doctor. The doctor looked at me. He says, "Well, you know, I think we can take care of this. Your blood pressure's up a little bit. You need an exercise program. You seem to be a little stressed. Come back and see me next week. I'll see you every week for about a month, then every 2 weeks, and every 3 weeks we'll get you on a program." It didn't last that long. After about a month, I went in to see him, and he was wanting to talk about you know what. Yeah. He was one of these doctors that did not appreciate good liquor. And he suspicioned that I was drinking too much of it. And I suspicioned that he was getting his information from one of them rotten Al-Anon meetings. Because I didn't know what was going on at our house for sure at that time. But anyhow, after a month, I went in and he had me jump up on the table and he took my blood pressure and his face kind of froze. And I said, "Do we have a problem, Doc?" And he said, "Yes." I said, "Well, what is it?" He said, "According to the gauge, you should be having a stroke now." Now, he said, "You lie back down here on the table. I want you to get some rest, and I'll be back in a minute." And he came in, he examined me. And, you know, it was 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'd made the supreme sacrifice. I hadn't had a drink all day. I'm used to having martinis for lunch. Now, I'm a little shaky at that time, you know. I know you've all been that way. And And, you know, you just kind of fly. Do you feel like you might fly if you just got the right kind of air on? And I am convinced by evidence, by my association with you, that if I were to pick up a drink today and start to drink, I could take that 3x5 card, put them all on there, and as I continue to drink, mark them off, one by one, until life itself would be gone. Well, my list was getting smaller. My self-confidence was down. The money was getting a little bit tight. The family situation was not good. I was having driver's license problems. I had 14 speeding tickets in a very short time, and the police were taking a dim view of that, and it seemed like all I had to do was back out of the driveway, put it in forward, and a police officer would just develop up here, and they'd say, "There's old Cheatham. Who wants him this time?" And they had me, but another thing was happening here. You see, at this, just about this time, my wife discovered Al-Anon. Now, and this was, as I mentioned, a very confusing thing to me, and things were easing up around the house. We used to, conversation was rather lax at our place, in fact, almost non-existent, because every time I talked, we ended up talking about my drinking. I could start talking about a ball game, and we end up talking about my drinking. But now this wasn't happening. She was going to these strange meetings, you know, and things were happening. Well, about this time, I had a son who was an outstanding football player. I still got him, by the way. Outstanding football player. Wrestled at 185 and heavyweight. Won all-conference championship 2 years in a row. About best described, I suppose you'd say, is just a chip off the old block is what it is. Dollar a ton. I mean, how could he miss? You know. But his coach was an old family friend of ours, known him for years, been in the Junior Chamber of Commerce with him. Old family friend. Now, what I didn't know is the coach was a member of this secret organization that had been formed in the city to look into my drinking. Have you ever noticed when there's a drinking problem in the family? It's the secret that everyone knows. It's almost like there was a crime scene tape around my house, you know. That yellow stuff, it's just kind of the way it seemed when I come home. But the coach came by. We'd been to the game on Friday night. We won, of course. My son was a hero. And he came by at 10:30 in the morning, and we visited a little bit. I'd already had a couple good hits of vodka at 10:30 in the morning, and I'm flying right. You know how it is when you're just right? Not too much, not too little, right in the middle, right in the middle. And I was there, and the coach came in, and he said, "I'd like to talk to you, Don, about your son," and he had a band at that time. "I'd like to talk to you about him." He said, could we take a ride?" I said, "Sure." We got in the car. We started driving around the countryside talking about nothing. Now, a drunk can spot that. You know, there was... We pull in south of Champaign, Illinois, there, and he said, "Let's pull in here and have a cup of coffee. You like to have a cup of coffee?" I said, "Sure, I'd like to have a cup of coffee." We go in there, and there's another friend of mine sitting up there on the stool, the mayor of Champaign, Illinois, old family friend. He said, "There's the mayor. I wonder if he'd like to have a cup of coffee." I said, "I bet he would." And the mayor, he falls in front. I'm in the middle. The coach is in the back. And they take me all the way to the back to a private room. Well, this tight air is starting to move in now. You know how that is, you know. The drunk can smell it. Something's wrong here, you know. And they had me. And so we go in the private room, and the waitress puts a coffee down there and three cups, and we're sitting there. And the mayor, he looks over at the coach. He says, "You know, I've got a very serious problem." He said, "I don't know what to do." He said, "A very dear friend of mine has got a drinking problem. I don't know what to do about it." Said his wife was by my office this week. Said she was concerned. The kids are concerned. His personality's changing. Just not him. He said, "I don't know what to do." Well, the coach said, "Do you think he's the kind of guy that you could just sit down and talk to him about it?" Well, the mayor said, "I don't know. It's just such a touchy subject." Well, about this time, I'm starting to get the drift of it. I just looked at him. I said, "You bastards talking about me?" And they said, "Yes," in unison. Well, the mayor said, "Now look, I have a good friend, highly educated, very intelligent, and he had this problem. And he's been able to live a life without alcohol now, very successful. He says, if I can get him to talk to you sometime, would you be willing to see him?" Well, now I understand my situation. I got no wheels. Alcohol content is low now. And they outnumbered 2-1. I said what any drunk would say. I said, "Why, yes." What I didn't know, he meant now. He fired out there to the telephone. He said, "I'll see if I can get the guy." Well, hell, you know the rest of it. The guy's sitting there waiting on the phone call. They load me up in the car and they drop me off by this bird's house and they said, "We'll see you later." And they left me with this guy. And as a result, I attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. But that's not the point that I want to make. The point I want to make is what I found out that day is something that I needed to know very badly, is that my family still cared, that my wife was concerned and deeply concerned, and my kids cared. I needed to know that because I thought it was pretty much all over the way things had been going. I am convinced that if there's a spark left, that marriages can go back together, people can go back together, with the help of these two programs. It can be done. Ellie and I are a testimonial to that thing because it was pretty bad shape. I'm glad that Ellie doesn't have to have a couple martinis every night before we have dinner. I'm very happy that she doesn't elect to grab the old ashes of the past about every week and throw them up in the air and let me look at them again and go over them again when my deportment was so unsuccessful. You don't do that. We just had to make a mark, and we moved on. So it was about, 33 years ago, I guess, that I attended my first meeting. And I went to this first meeting. I went for 6 weeks. I didn't agree. I was very uncomfortable. I had a pretty good idea I wasn't going to stick around. I was miserable, and I drank again. But you see, I wouldn't let you do anything for me while I was there. It was all me. I was kind of looking for a way to take over the meetings. And it didn't work out that way. But so I went out and I drank again. But it wasn't all my fault. You should have seen this place where they took me for treatment. There was a little house behind the hospital where I attended my first meeting. This house had these imitation shingles on them, you know, and they were all falling off, a few scabs hanging on the side. The front step was gone. They just kind of kicked a concrete block in there that you stepped up on. The screen door was about to fall. I mean, you had to handle it very gently to get in and out or she'd go down. The coffee pot was dirty, and the cups were chipped. I don't know where they got the furniture for this building. They had these big overstuffed couches, you know, and the springs were coming out of the bottom. And when you sat down, you had to get her set just right to follow that spring down, or you'd get a thrill like you'd never had before. I mean, and they had chairs to match them. And then they had four lamps in that place with 40-watt bulbs and heavy shades. I mean, you could barely see across the room. And I would come home and I'd tell my wife, "They ain't going to make it. Ain't no need to get involved with these people. They won't survive." I said, "They start a meeting at 8 o'clock. Nobody knows who's going to run the meeting. Finally, someone says, I'll take it. People talk an hour a turn. Don't even ask to be recognized. One guy'll talk, another guy'll talk, and they read from this book, and the money." I said, "The money." They pass a basket around. Guy in an old dirty pair of blue jeans and an old T-shirt will get up and get that money out of that basket and just fold her once, and sticker in his pocket and tell you never see him again. And I've never heard a treasurer's report. And I said, with my organization ability alone, I think I could save it. But they never called on me for some reason. So I went back, and I drank again. It was a tough. The last year I drank has got to be the hardest work I ever did. Trying to work, trying to protect the fly. Back in about October of 69, during the football season, my son got a football injury. Somebody put a helmet on his knee and knocked him out. And it caused me to drink a lot. Now, I'd like to say I got drunk because of that, but when you're drunk, when it happens, it don't fit, you know. And I had been drinking a lot. Now, I had a good break that night because the police at that time had my driver's license, and the neighbor drove me to the game, so I didn't have to worry too much about drinking and driving. But it put me down, and I drank for about a week. And I drank to one of those places where I couldn't get sober, and I couldn't get drunk. And I know you've all been there. You don't know what happens, but it ain't working, and it ain't not working. It's just bad. And it was a bad time. And I got up this morning about 6 o'clock in the morning, and I went downstairs to my office/bar, and I had a few drinks. And then I laid my head down on the desk and took a little nap. I understand you used to call that passing out, but I didn't know it at that time. I just used to sleep a lot. And I took a little nap. And about 11 o'clock that morning, my wife came down. Now, my sweet wife is one that when I quit going to Alcoholics Anonymous, she kept going to Al-Anon every Wednesday night. She kept going. Had she not done that, I don't think what transpired could possibly have transpired. Ellie and I have been sweethearts since we were freshmen in high school. Married as soon as we could get a license. She came down and she said, could we talk? Well, when I got to the point where I could just make a noise, I said yes. And she said, look, if this thing isn't working between you and me anymore, she said, I guess it'll have to be okay. If you don't want to be here with me and the children anymore, and it looks like this thing isn't going to work, she said, it'll have to be okay. But she said, would you please let me help you? She said, I can't let you die. And for some reason, I said yes. We got in the car and we shot up to the newly formed Champaign Council on Alcoholism. We got me a reservation up in Hazelden, up in Center City, Minnesota, up by Minneapolis. And we came home, and luckily I had about a half of a quart left that I could keep my courage up, and I kept working on that. Till the kids got home from school, we held a little family conference that I thought I conducted, but that was not true. I just attended it. And then we went up to the airport at 6 o'clock to put me on the train from the plane from Minneapolis, Minnesota. We got up there, and they announced the plane was going to be a little late, and I was feeling pretty good. And I told Ellie, you'll go on home. I'll catch the plane. She said, no way. She said, I'll be waiting with you. I had my eye on a Budweiser sign there at the airport. And so I had a real quick connection in O'Hare, only had time for 2 drinks there, and then I had a couple drinks on the plane on up to Minnesota, and the time I got up there, I was ready for some healing, and we went out there. But you know, I found something out there that I didn't know when I got into Hazelton and got by the detox situation. They told me, you're going to have to do this for yourself, and I didn't know that. You see, my mother had tried, my wife had tried, my kids had tried, my brother had tried. I'd been through 2 preachers. And the police had certainly made a contribution. But I thought they all wanted to do it for them. They told me I was going to have to do it for me. Finally, I got into one of those lectures, and Dr. Heilman from the VA hospital came over, the first lecture I attended. And he explained the disease of alcoholism, and I was very attentive. He said, disease? I got a disease. That means I might be able to get well. He explained that I had a mental obsession. I knew that. I could buy that. I wanted to drink all the time. And he said, you have the physical allergy. Once you take it, you can't quit. I could relate to that. How many times did I stop at 4:30 to get one drink and close the place up at 2? One drink, I could relate to that. He says, you lack the power to overcome this thing. We'll show you the power. He said, the power is the AA group. And get connected to a higher power. Now, I could understand that. I just didn't know if I could do it all. He said, alcohol does not affect everyone that way. It affects certain people. If you're here, you're probably one of them. He said, we call it alcoholism. And there is a way out. Well, I just sat there and cried. I was so thrilled to find out there was something wrong with me. I just thought I'd died, gone to hell, I forgot to light the fire. Because life was that bad. But I found something else while I was there. In that book, Came to Believe, it talks about the tightest prison that was ever made. It's that prison that we make for ourselves, where we get so boxed in. And that's what happened to me. And that's when I came to believe. You see, I couldn't sleep at night. So I would get up 2 o'clock in the morning, maybe again at 3, maybe at 4. I would go down to the chapel. And as those moonbeams would come in those blue and red leaded windows, I was on my knees. And I was asking God to help me. Wasn't trying to bargain no more. I was asking for help. And it was a simple thing. Just show me the way. I can't see leaving this place and never drinking again. Please show me the way. And he did. From that day until this moment, he's been with me. It's been a very slow thing. It's been a very sure thing. But I always knew it was there. God had never moved. I did all the moving. And he was waiting. I can find God in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know he just ain't looking for me. He might be looking for you or someone else who's struggling and having trouble. And he's there, and I found him. Well, there was no sudden explosion when I found God. No flashing lights. No one appeared over here in a burning bush. No one ran down the side of the mountain and read a bunch of tablets to me. I mean, it was just a very slow thing that happened. And finally, I discovered what did happen to me because I read in the book, The 12 Steps and the 12 Traditions. There's a place in there that it says, when the time comes that you are able to do, feel, and believe that which you could not do before on your own unaided resources, then you've had a spiritual awakening. Well, I must have had one of those things, because that's exactly what was happening to me. Things were coming easier now. Things were better. And I felt more confident. Well, they finally released me from Hazleton. It was a 4-5 decision. But they let me out. And I got on that airplane, and I was headed back for Champaign-Urbana, and I remembered what my counselor said. If you go back, and everybody's not in favor of you going back, but if you go back and get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, you'll make it. If you don't, you won't. And I got on the plane. I got to think, God, I don't want to go back to that AA thing. That dirty old house and cups and the damn house and all that kind of stuff. And I just don't want to go back in there. And besides that, when I was in there before, I heard one of them old heads pull one of them new guys off to one side. And he counseled him, you know. He said, Alcoholics Anonymous, you know, is a $1 million program. Shoved up your ass a nickel at a time. So I knew I was going to have a lot of change on my hands, but I got down there. A lot of it. Well, I went back, And sure enough, things hadn't changed much. All they were talking about, don't drink, go to meetings. I could tell them I'm having family problems. They say, don't drink, go to meetings. Business problems, don't drink, go to meetings. Flat tire, don't drink, go to meetings. It'll be all right. After about 20 years in this program, I decided if I could find some way to say don't drink and go to meetings, I could do a great service for this organization. And I looked and I looked and I looked, and I thought, that's the oldest cliche that we have. About 10 years ago, I found it. I was in San Juan, Puerto Rico. I was a little seedy restaurant down there. Now, the only thing seedier than the restaurant was the restroom. But I had to go. And I went into the restroom, and there it was, a sign hanging right behind the john. It said, hang on to the handle till it all flushes down. And I said, that's it. That's what we're talking about. We get in here and we get the whole thing all flushed out. That was it. But you know, that's what we're doing here. And the fellowship by the sea, what an illustration. Well, you know, last Friday, last Saturday, the 2 or 3 hours that you could spend down there at the tables talking to everyone, that's what we're doing, isn't it? We're flushing it down. We're getting that old stuff of the past. Well, you know, as I sit down there, I get so filled. I can just hear the man upstairs looking down and just kind of shaking his head and going like that and all. And saying, you know what? 65 years ago, when I introduced Dr. Bob and Bill, this is exactly what I had in mind. Exactly. Each one teach one. Each one teach two. And you go out in the multitudes and you help yourself and you form a bond. That's what I had in mind. I knew you, my kids, were going to run into trouble down there. I had to send them some help, and you picked it up and you're doing the job. I can almost hear him saying that now. Well, don't drink. Go to meetings. That's the way it works. It's hard to beat it. You know, stick with the winners. We've heard that story before. Stick with the winners. There's a lot to be said for that. I think best illustration, they tell me down in southern Illinois, every Monday morning they wash. Only we call it in southern Illinois, wash. But every Monday morning in southern Illinois, they wash. And this is what was happening on this morning. This little old lady, she jumps out of bed and she jumps into her little old dirty tennis shoes and she throws on her house coat. Now, when she threw on her house coat, that's all she had on because she slept nude. And she went downstairs into the washroom and she threw the washing into the machine and she looked at the robe and it looked rather soiled and she thought, well, I'll just wash it too. So she removed the robe and she threw it into the machine and she... About that time, I felt some water on her head and looked up, and there was some condensation on the pipes up there. And she thought, well, a rag, a scarf, and she couldn't find anything. But over on the bench was her son's football helmet. So she reached over and got the football helmet and put the football helmet on, and she's washing away, and about that time, a little old gent comes down the back steps to read the water meter. And he looks in there, and he surveys the situation, and he walked back by, and he read the water meter. Now, she couldn't hear him. The machine was running. She couldn't see him. Her back was turned. And he came back, and he looked back in that washroom again, and he walked back up, and he got about halfway up the steps, and he couldn't take her no more. I mean, he stopped, and he removed his hat, and he bowed very gently, and he said, pardon me, madam, I couldn't leave without telling you that I hope your team wins. Well, we got a winning team here. A great winning team. But, you know, I remember when I was trying to figure this thing out all alone, life was no fun at that point. I was trying to figure the thing out. It just didn't work. I was drinking hard. The debts were piling up. And And it was just another bunch of crap every day until I finally got involved with you. But since I've known you, I've had more fun, more happiness. You know, you told me you're going to enjoy a new freedom and a new happiness. And I want you to know I've found that. It's been great. I've never had such a wonderful trip. And it's the only place I could come, around the tables, around the smoke-filled rooms. It's just been a great thing. I'm about through here, you know, in case you're wondering about checking out. I'd better be. I got to catch a plane. I wanted you to know that. I don't want to be in the situation they were telling me about they were holding a meeting such as this, and one of the old bleeding deacons come in through the back door, and they thought before they started the meeting that best they let him come up and say hello and just be respectful, and they called him up to the front of the room. And 15 minutes later, he was still saying hello. Well, the chairman got excited. He said, "I've got to do something about this." So he reached over and he grabbed the gavel, and he said, "I'll just have to gavel him down. That's all there is to it." Well, he brought that gavel down real hard. It slipped out of his hand, and he caught the guy in the front row right across the eye. The blood started spewing out of the guy, and they rushed over to him, and as he was going down, he was heard to say, "Hit me again. I can still hear him." Well, I don't want to be in a situation like this, so as soon as I tell you about Lazarus, I'm going to quit. You know, Lazarus, our Methodist preacher, he was one of those guys that would always give me all of his drunks. And he always, around the Easter time, he liked to talk about Lazarus, the unanswerable witness. And I can't tell the story as eloquently as he can, but the story goes like this, that Jesus was walking down the street, and he bumped into somebody, and the guy said, "Hey, Jesus, your buddy Lazarus, he died. You better go check him out." Well, Lazarus went over, and Jesus went over, and there was Lazarus, and he was stretched out, and he was dead, and been dead 3 days. And Jesus looked at him and said, "Lazarus, you're not dead. You're merely sleeping. Rise and follow me." And he did. Well, I always wanted to jump up on the end of the pew and wave my program and say, "Hey, preacher, that's strong stuff you're peddling around here, boy. If somebody came by and rescued me from the dead, I'd be a pretty good witness, too." But the point is, that's exactly what you did for me. You see, I was moving on the outside, but I was dead on the inside. I was a goner in there. And you came by. And you said, "Follow me. Fall in behind me, and I'll show you the way." And you did. And it's been a great trip. When I think of the work that we can do, I'm reminded of the story that they tell over in Scotland about the old lamplighter. How he used to come along at dusk with his ladder and his lamp, and how he would put them up against the lamppost and climb the ladder and light the old gas lamp and move on to the next and the next. And as the story goes, that as the night wore on, you could never tell where the old lamplighter was, but you could always tell where he had been by the lights that he had lighted. So I say to us, if we want to be successful, if we want to be more than successful, if we want to be personally and permanently and happily successful, let us lead our lives and do our work in such a way that it makes no difference where we are. People will always know where we have been by the lights that we have lighted. And I'm very pleased and proud and honored that you would ask me to be here this morning. I'm very happy that I could come. Thanks. Thank you.